back in then, right?
I'm sorry, that was a little bit garbled. Who joined us on the phone that, what was the comment?
This is Tim. I just, each time we change session, we have to call, dial back in with a new password, right?
Excuse me, Natalie Fredrin joined.
Hello. This is awful. What is the name?
Oh, Tommy Drummer.
Bob Conley is finding it again for the compliance section.
Is anybody there?
Yeah, Joyce, Lynn, I'm 007 names.
Hi, Joyce.
Are you online too, or about telephone, or what?
A telephone, yes.
Okay, thank you.
No, we're in session yet. This is all it.
It seems strange to have to sign again after that first one. But,
are we in compliance session, or are we still in closed session?
Well, that's the close is finished. Got back from Japan yesterday. Got all the clocks in the house are wrong.
Hello.
Okay, Maggie. All right, with that, I think we'll start the session on compliance. Thanks.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I feel like at this singing, dancing show performance. Real happy to be here with you guys. We've got lots of updates to share with you. We've been kind of working in collaboration with different team members from the Registrar Stakeholder Group, and I want to thank you in advance for your support and effort through this past trimester. So, Greg, do you want me to say next slide or just head shake?
Next slide, I think, probably is the easiest way to do it.
Volker
will be assisting.
Okay. Next slide, please. So, very happy to announce to the team, you know, we've been trying to grow our staff. Since the Dakar meeting, we have four additional staff members. In me with the audience, I've got one of the new staff members is Jack Kawaja. Jack is responsible for risk and audit management. But I also have with me Jonathan and Pam Little, whom you have probably worked with a lot. So the organization now in our department, we can cover up to seven languages. We've been focusing really well about what is the subject matter expertise and the diversity we bring to the team, because we deal with a very diverse audience, and it's very important to understand the nuances, the languages, and the diversity in the ICANN community. So the organization, I'm the head of the compliance department. We are now structuring ourselves, since we are growing, we're structuring ourselves into what we call a core compliance group that focuses on registrar and registry. Our objective is to have cross-functional team that we can leverage as it's needed, based on volume, based on complaints, based on demands. We want to be able to do that cross-functionality from subject matter expertise. Two key roles we added to the organization, risk and audit management, to help us put it all in perspective. You know, we want to make sure we are looking at the issues or the challenges is based on the risks they present to the ICANN community. And the audit management will come parallel to that activity, because we also want to strengthen our audit strategy, process, methodology, and become more active in that area. The third role that was key to our organization is the performance measurement and reporting. You know, the ICANN community is all about transparency. So how do we do it? What do we do it with? And all this stuff. So this gentleman comes to us, Paul, with very strong IT background, but very strong dashboard, KPI, and measurement and reporting. So we past trimester focused a lot on the data mining, and you'll see in the next few slides how we're going to be presenting to you the data. It's no more about volume. It's volume with more business intelligence to it. And as we evolve, we're going to strengthen that part. Next slide, please. It's important for you guys to know what our three-year plan, because we work directly with the contracted parties. Anything we do in touch will eventually impact you. But also, we need to collaborate so we can really put together a strong strategy and strong team. So our three-year plan is focused on two key strategic initiatives from the ICANN strategic plan. Core operations, basically focusing on strengthening the program and the operations, which you've been hearing about over the past few ICANN meetings. And the second initiative is establishing performance measurement and improving on our reporting for transparency and accountability. So we completed 2011. We put together a plan in 2011, and we've been executing to that plan, and we are on plan for 2012. There are slides at the end with more additional depth and information to those, so I'm not going to take you to that level. Next slide, please. You've all have seen the pyramid, the culture of compliance. I was pleased to see that those words are being used in many forums. If you've attended different presentations or different audiences yesterday, I've heard it's mentioned, culture of compliance, in many different forums. But it's really a bottom-up. We are a multi-stakeholder model, and it is not only upon compliance to make sure everybody's in compliance. It takes each and every one of us. So this past trimester, again, we've had eight registrars who volunteered and worked with our team to do what we call the annual self-assessment. We have a list of 15 questionnaires based on the contractual obligations, where we ask specific questions and ask for facts and data to support those. This is in pilot phase. So what does it mean? We need to assess. We've collected feedback from the pilot registrars on several aspects. Is it easy as a tool to use? How much time did it take you to bring and send us this data? But most importantly, we also have to assess it from our perspective. As you know, the registrar community is large. So each of you have different operationals, different standards, different templates. We need to assess it and see what is the data we're getting, how long it takes us to get it also. So we will complete this assessment in this next trimester. Our first obligation is to get back with the registrar pilot team. That's the first step, to share with them the feedback, to share with them the challenges and what we've learned from this pilot and the next steps. So we'll come back in June to share that with you. The other steps you're very familiar with, you know, we've in the past we've led more of a reactive role. We're taking more proactive, preventive role, and you'll see that translated into the next slides. Next, please. So the focus since my arrival has been two simple questions. Are we doing whatever we're doing, are we doing it right? But the other question, which is important, are we doing the right thing? So in that effort, we have successfully completed this past trimester, standardizing on all our communication. I have even had some registrars contact me. It's like, what you've done, this is changing. I said, yes, hopefully it's clearer. Hopefully it's more direct. And it's more fact-based, because we really need to have the facts from the beginning instead of playing a ping-pong game. We send you an email, you send us an email, and vice versa. Let's just address it based on that contractual provision, whether it's a notice or an inquiry. We ask for the facts up front. It saves you time and email, and it saves us also that time, so we have a more efficient way. The communication has been very simplified. We turned it into business communication, less legal terms, because we really don't know who from your perspective and your organization is receiving this in the compliance department. We want to make sure we're making it very clear, very consistent, but also, again, against the ICANN multi-stakeholder model. Effectiveness, as I said earlier, we have analyzed the volumes, and we've got some steps that we're working towards, and we'll share it with you. Next, please, Greg. This overall process, you've heard us talk about it since Dakar. It is final. We have finished it. This process, I know it does not have swim lanes. If you are a process subject matter expert, you know it will have swim lanes, roles, and responsibilities. What we want to do is bring it up a notch. We do have swim lanes, but bring it up a notch to say basically from a compliance department, like in your organization, we receive complaints in many different forms and formats. Think of it as an intake system. Whether it's a registrar or a registry, it does not matter. The process for compliance is going to be consistent. We start with the side where we say good standing side. It's the preventive collaborative side where we are monitoring or auditing or receiving and complaints. We process them in three steps. We call it the three strikes before you get to enforcement. The process is going to be consistent across all contractual provisions, no matter which one we're looking at, transfer, who is inaccuracy, it doesn't matter, RDE, they will all have the same process steps. And it should be very clear within your organization when you receive it to know where you are in the process. The title will reflect clearly first inquiry or first notice. It depends on the complaint we receive. If we have enough facts, we send a notice. If it's not, we send an inquiry because we want to collect facts so we can make fact-based decision. Please let your team know that we will send the first inquiry or notice via email. So it's really important to have your information correct and radar. The second inquiry, so every inquiry that's going to be sent is going to be clearly what step it is, when is the response due by, and what is expected from that inquiry. So you should have the when, what, and by. So it should be very clear. Let's say the end of that time frame happens. We have not heard. We send a follow-up by a second inquiry or a second notice. And you notice that in the blue, we start with email. We move to email and phone call, email, phone call, and fax. We try to exhaust the communication means we have to reach out. If by the third notice we have not heard, or it has not been, you know, we've exchanged emails, or it's not been cured, or it's not been corrected, and we don't have all the information. Worst case scenario, if we have not heard, our team has worked really hard this past trimester and tightened the process. We are turning this hot potato in 2 business days, a breach notice. In the past, because of the volume, because of the whatever, lack of resources, sometimes we'd sit for a couple of days or weeks before we issue a breach notice. 2 business days from that date, we issue a breach notice. The breach notice is very clear, succinct communication. If you've gone on our website, you will notice it. It should not exceed a page. But it has attachment of the chronology that should reflect all the facts and the steps that led up to a breach notice. That's all in the spirit of accountability and transparency. I do want to let this audience know we have been pushed to stop publishing from step one, and we tell everybody in the community that is not what we're going to do, because there's got to be a spirit of collaboration and fact-finding amongst us and the contracted parties. But once it reaches a breach notice, you all know we publish on our website. It's published. It's common knowledge. Now it's moved into what we call a not in good standing. Let's say the phase for the breach notice ends and we have not heard or it has not been cured. So all the events that would lead up to a breach notice, I want you to know in the past we also used to process complaints in silos. Transfer complaint by itself. Who is it? Inaccuracy by itself. Now we're taking a step back. We are, after the first inquiry, we're looking at the complaints, not only by volume, but by registrar. So we want to, again, it's part of our efficiency and effectiveness. What other areas are we seeing happening in this registrar space? And we're going to combine and send it to you in the second and third. So by the time we reach breach, we're really managing the bigger picture, not just a complaint at a time. So the breach notice period expires. It has not been cured. We will examine the history. You know, we have a slide on the suspension, and we'll talk to it in more details. Then the decision is made whether to suspend, terminate, or non-renew. It's based on what is the process going through. No matter what goes on and what's the next step, we will update the website with that next step. Next slide, please. A process that's going to be very different, and you're probably going to feel the impact of that the most. We spent a lot of effort and time. You know who is has been a very, inaccuracy has been a very talked about subject in the community. We're not reacting to that. We're reacting to a process in our group that was not leading up to effective and efficient results and outcomes. So I'm only showing you this process, but like I said, the three steps that lead from prevention to enforcement are applied to all. I'm only showing you in WDPRS because we assessed, and a lot of the volume and the complaints that we get from a WDPRS system, the WHOIS inaccuracy. In the past, we'd send a 15-day notice followed by a 45-day notice, you know, take reasonable steps. No, we put all that aside. We are going to respect what's in the contract, of course. But we moved to really fact-based steps. From the first step, you will receive a notice. It will refer to the right obligations, what's expected. But we're going to ask for facts up front so that we and you are collaborating from the beginning to address this complaint or issue at once. So currently, the registrars only are required to show proof if they have not responded after the third. The revised approach, which is step 1, 2, 3, is going to be requiring that you provide proof up front. Next slide, please, Graham. The suspension process, the criteria, you know, if you are on the 2009 RAA, you should be familiar with it. But we also have published frequently asked questions that apply to not only registrars, registrant, but also registries. I'm not sure if you have seen it on our website, but I highly recommend it. It has a lot of good information that we received across different areas, and we formalized it into this link. In general, the suspension period can be up to 12 months, but the determination of the duration is based on the behavior, the number of breaches, the number of complaints, where we, again, we have collected facts, we've collected data throughout this time, and that will be based on that. As you know, we currently have a registrar in suspension, and the suspension period was determined for 30 days. If the suspension, by the end of the suspension period, it has not been cured, we are asking for proof before the end of the period. But by then, we should know if it's going to be cured, how far are they in that curing process to be able to determine what would be the next step. So again, it's a case by case, but we wanted to put a general idea for you here so you know what is the logic of that suspension period. Next, please. One more. What I'd like to do is turn this slide on operational update for Pam to share with you how are we doing the data mining, what are we looking at doing, and we want to share with you what are some of the internal steps we're going to be taking and doing to work with our contracted parties.
Thanks, Maggie. Hi, everyone. Okay, so Maggie shared with us, and I hope you have a better understanding about our contractual compliance model, our philosophy, our approach, our general process. Now, in the next few slides, I will share with you some of the compliance data relating to the last trimester, which is still ongoing till, I guess, the end of the week. During T2 so far, up to February, we received 16,000 complaints. And in the previous slide, you'll see we actually have a number of complaint intake system, including one for the who is inaccuracy, one for the general consumer complaints, and one for the UDRP. And we also receive complaints through emails or even telephone calls. So we aggregate this and came up to this figure. And this is the geographic location or distribution of where those complaints are relating to, mainly registrars. So these are where the registrars are located. Next slide, please. This one is really just elaborating what the areas of complaints or the complaints are concerned about. And you can see who is the top one spot, the top spot, which is over 9,500. We also receive large amount of complaints, which are really customer service related. When we say customer services, we mean like, you know, my registrar charging me such high fee or whatever, or my registrar is not returning my email, responding to my email, returning my call, that kind of thing. So 4,000 of those are relating to customer service, which we generally don't have contractual authority to deal. The RAA doesn't dictate what sort of level of customer support or help desk service you have to provide. So it's kind of a difficult area for us. But the next one that we could deal with is the transfer issues, transfer problems, and we do receive a lot of those. As you can see in T2, we have over 2,000 transfer-related complaints. This means the inter-registrar transfer-related complaints. And Maggie also shared with you the three-strike or the preventative versus the enforcement approach in different stages. So out of these complaints, we generally just follow these inquiry or notice process, send first, then second and third notices to registrars concerned. And obviously those numbers will gradually decrease from first inquiry to second and to third. Some of the complaints actually we didn't have to send the first inquiry, actually got resolved by then. So if it doesn't get resolved by the third notice, then we have that internal escalation from prevention to enforcement, and that resulted in two notices of breach and one notice of suspension in T2. Next slide, please. This again shows where the complaints are in a sort of geographic, demographic view, if you like, and we provided the registration volume in each region as well as the registrar number in each region. And so you can see how many complaints versus the registration volume and the number of complaints versus the registrars in that region. And there's a detailed sort of a, you know, notation in slide 25 if you are interested in reading more into this data. Next slide, please. This is what Maggie mentioned about efficiency and effectiveness. You know, we have all these complaints through the general coming to us, and we are trying to sort of work more effectively with the registrars. We recognize registrar education outreach is part of our function as part of the preventative remit we want to do. So we're trying to identify, for example, in the transfer area, we have who are the most problematic registrars that are most complained about or against. So this is what we've done, and we are able to get this data and see, hey, there seem to be some problem in, for example, the top four are from China. So how do we work with those registrars to help them understand their obligation in terms of inter-registrar transfer policy? So I have the work cut out for me. So as you can see, 4 out of 5 actually is in Asia or in China. And this is one of the initiatives we want to try to not just work hard, but also work smart. Next slide, please. And again, with WHOIS, we know a number of registrars sort of, you know, constantly occupying the top 10. Again, we want to apply the same approach. Identify the low-hanging fruit, address those fundamental and the root cause so we can address the problem more effectively and work more directly with the registrars. And hopefully, eventually, we can reduce the number of complaints coming through to us. And that's kind of the purpose of identifying those most complained registrars. Next slide, please. So this is about who is inaccuracy demographics distribution. So again, this is where the registrations are from this slide. Just sort of self-explanatory. Next one, please. The registrar's location, yeah. So, of course, you can see in North America, you have the largest number of registrars and also largest number of registration, right? So it's kind of understandably that you have the highest percentage in terms of where the complaints are, right, concerning those registrars. Next one, please. This is the Who is Inaccuracy complaint, some sort of data analysis for you. We have received 9,500, and we close so many. And when we say close, on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see these are the criteria we apply to say how a ticket will be deemed closed. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. As you probably all have received this audit request recently that was launched in, I think, back in January. So this is the data, Who is Data Reminder Policy audit we conduct every year. This will be the last year we actually conduct a separate Who is Data Reminder Policy audit. In the future, we're hoping to integrate this obligation into the overall RAA self-assessment audit. And these are the preliminary results from the responses those registrar kindly provided. And we have this response rate lower response rate than previous years. And I will try to explain to you why this is the case. In the past, we have a much longer open window to complete this audit or to respond to this audit. This time, we try to kind of be more disciplined to say, hey, it's going to be open for this period, and after that, we're going to follow that second notice, third notice process, and that's what we've done. And we are in the process of sending the final notice to those who did not respond to the audit request, who have the obligation to respond, i.e. under the 2009 RAA, and also they have sponsor names. Next slide, please. So this, again, is analysis about the preliminary audit results. If you've seen the questionnaire of the audit, you've seen these are the questions and these are the responses we got from the registrars. And we can come back to these slides if you have questions later on. Next slide, please. I want to talk a little bit about this registrar self-assessment. Greg kindly helped us solicit interest from a number of registrars to participate in this pilot audit that we ran in February. So the registrar self-assessment, we just trial at the moment. So we asked some volunteer registrar to help us to test the questions, to test the tool, as Maggie has mentioned earlier. And this is and we also, after they participate in the audit or responded to the audit, we sent out a survey asking them to give us feedback about those questions about the tool. And these are the survey results. So as you can see, the feedback is generally very positive. So we're very encouraged by that. So our next step, as Maggie has said, we're going to assess the responses we get from those volunteer registrars, and also test how long it's going to take us to assess each registrar's response. There are 14 questions in the self-assessment questionnaire, 14 fixed questions, if you like, so they have a kind of a binary answer, yes and no or not applicable, and one open question. And we also asked registrar to tell us how long it took them to complete the self-assessment. So you can see they're sort of evenly distributed in terms of the time taken a registrar to do the self-assessment. But overall, we are encouraged by the survey results. Next slide, please. We also conducted a compliance outreach survey results in February. And those who again participated told us what sort of format they would prefer, what sort of topics they are interested in. This is, again, part of our initiative. We want to do that prevention versus cure approach. We want to help our registrar to understand their obligations to start with, so their practices or business process will be in compliance in the first place, rather than a reactive approach where we have to send notice and termination, that kind of thing. So this is what they're telling us, and we will take into account and plan our outreach activities and schedule accordingly, and the topics. Next slide, please. So that is all I have in terms of compliance activity from an operational perspective. So Maggie and I will be happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. I have a couple of people in the queue, and anyone listening online, you can just post in the or anyone in the room who's not online, go to the Adobe chat room and post there that you want to be in the queue, and we'll get you there. Michaela, you were in the queue first.
Thanks, Greg. A couple of things. Firstly, for Maggie. Then don't worry, Pam, I'll get to you. You were
ready for you.
I know. It's a simple question. You're talking about a revised process on your slides there. I think it was in relation to the WPRS, possibly.
Greg, do you mind going back to that slide?
Sure. Tell us. Do you remember which number it is? Well, keep on going back, Michaela. When you see it, tell us to stop.
Yes.
Slow down. Keep going. There, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're talking about revising the process. So the currently registrars are required to show proof they've not responded after 3 ICANN inquiries, and you're talking about changing that. Where is this change going? I mean, are we talking about a change within a potentially modified RAA, or is this an internal compliance process? If you could just speak to that, it would be helpful.
Okay. So the proposed change process, we haven't implemented a new process because we need also to change our tool, the WHOIS data reminder policy problem, that intake system. What we are really talking about here is, in the first notice you will get under this new process, we also ask you to provide copies of correspondence you have with the registrant in terms of when you address that WHOIS inaccuracy claim. And that's actually in the RAA. Section 342 of the RAA requires registrar to retain all that data and also provide that data to ICANN upon request. So we are referencing those provisions in the first notice to registrar concerned, saying please also provide the relevant correspondence you have with the registrant. So we can see you actually have attempted to take reasonable steps to investigate. And we ask to see records of correspondence with registrant. So that's the key.
So basically what you're doing is you're revising your process, but it's based on the existing contract.
Yes.
Absolutely. We will always respect what's in the contractual scope. Again, we use this specific example because it's the hot topic du jour, but we also wanted to share with you, you know, it is an inefficiency because different provisions, different areas, we were working siloed approaches. We're consolidating, we're growing the team. Our standard operating procedures need to be a foundational effort where we're going to grow next year, focus on continuous improvement and all this new growth that's coming our way. Consistency in the process across all contracted parties, all contractual provisions.
Okay, and kind of a follow-up then. As usual, when you present the statistics with respect to the number of complaints the compliance has received, transfers as usual is top of the list. However, I mean, no offense, ladies, but kind of this throwing all transfer-related complaints into this great big bucket of transfers without providing a higher level of detail, from my perspective as a registrar, is quite problematic, especially when I consider the hundreds of hours that myself, Matt, James, and several others have spent trying to deal with these issues in the never-ending IRTP series of PDPs. I mean, from our from my perspective, it would be very helpful to have a higher level of detail and also work with you to see if we can actually move some of those complaints away from transfers, because as we've already seen in the past, when we had access to more granular data, a lot of them were misclassified.
So if I may answer, not just in perspective to transfers, you saw two slides here that we had the big yellow highlight to cover. The idea here is, you know, you've heard it also this week, low-hanging fruits. You know, we don't want to overuse these terminologies. But the idea is to bring focus and bring depth, not just process like robotically without knowing what is the root cause. So the idea here is a collaborative effort. The process will run its course, but we do want to collaborate by putting in a conference call with the impacted area, right? What are the issues we're facing? What does that mean? Where do we take it from here? How can we measure it? How can we reduce it? Just to bring it to the next level of collaboration so we can also measure how are we addressing those root causes? Are we addressing them effectively and reducing them? So exactly to your point, but I want you to think of it not just from transfers perspective in some of the other areas that are high volume. What is that root cause and how can we work it through?
And Michaela, just to add to that, if we could help with the PARC PDP, if you need any data from us, we're happy to see what we can do. As you know, last time we spent enormous amount of time to provide data for PARC-B, IRTP PARC-B, right?
Yeah, which was very helpful. I mean, it's the thing from my perspective is when I see that statistic popping up every single time, and then you see other members of the community lambasting us about it. The thing is that we had a conversation with compliance about this probably, I don't know, James might remember, or Matt, about 2 years ago, about improving the tools that you guys use to collect the complaints. And the fear I have is that 2 years later, the collection of the complaints is still using the same methodology, the same tools, and you're still getting, well, how can I put this politely, bad data, and that it hasn't improved, whereas a lot of things could be improved and could have been improved back then, and you know we're still dealing with it now.
Okay, I have one more month to celebrate 1 year anniversary at ICANN, so I was not here during that discussion. Can I get one more trimester? Let's try this out and see how it evolves.
Maggie, would you stop using that charm? It's not fair.
No, it's not charm, dear. We want to reduce those and look at them smartly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
I know James had a, or
yeah, I have
somebody
a queue,
had a. Yeah.
I have a queue going, which is James, Tim Ruiz, Jeff Eckhouse, and then Elliot. Let me know in the chat room if there's more than that. All right. Thanks. James.
Thanks, Gray. And thanks, Maggie and Pam. Just a quick question relative to slide number 12, and I think Michaela may have already touched on some of this, but I was a little shocked when I saw this because my understanding was that far and away the largest complaint category was transfer related, and now looks like that has been pushed to third. Is this a change, in your opinion, is this a shift in the complaint activity, or is this just a function of your recategorization of the types of complaints that you're receiving, or is this just an example, or I'm confused.
Okay, so this is really a matter of presentation. In the past, we don't aggregate all complaints, and when you see data, or when we were telling you that the transfer complaint is the biggest bucket out of C-ticket system. CW, the who is inaccuracy actually comes through a different ticketing system. Therefore, we were reporting different systems, right, based on system, intake system. Now we thought it would be better to have a holistic view about all different types of complaints. So see, the one of the slides earlier was the three intake systems we have. One for who is, one for general consumer complaint, that's C-ticket, and one for UDRP related. So this is all together out of those three intake systems and plus emails, phone calls. Okay? Does that
so you don't, yes, so you don't see any kind of shifting trend away from transfers towards who is or anything like that? That's not the story you're trying to tell with this?
No, it's not. This, and who is always around, like, okay. I would say around 2,000 a month.
Okay.
And C-ticket will be over 1,000.
And I just wanted to point out that you have been, I think, you should be commended for reaching out to registrars. I know that we've shared a number of ideas, including a white paper on how to operationally change some of the WHOIS data reporting systems. As you might aware, we deal with that in volume as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're willing to share that not only with ICANN but with also with all the other registrars here if it will help you build some internal processes to track these down. Thanks.
And thank you. Thanks for that initiative, too. As I share with our colleagues, that's really a perfect example of this multi-stakeholder model self-regulation work. Good job.
Thanks. Next, we have Tim. And I think we'll just read the two questions that Tim had put in the put into the chat room. You have Volker has them, sorry.
Tim Ruiz asks, with the change in expected response to WHOIS data problems problem reports, what in turn is ICANN going to do to reduce the number of bogus reports?
Reduce the number of what?
With the change expected in response to WHOIS data problem reports, what is in turn ICANN going to do to reduce the number of bogus reports?
Well, I think the system already actually have some sort of filtering at the moment. So we are looking into how we can further enhance the system so we can improve in that area. People will always, you know, it's an open system. They can always file complaints, you know. So we either hard-coded the system to filter further or we have more manual review. It's a balancing act, how much we can filter invalid complaints.
So we do realize that we do get bogus reports. So as we are looking towards our future requirements and future consolidated systems, that would be one of the requirements. How can we tag those bogus reporters so we can make sure we do not allow it to go back through or something? So we have that on the future stage, but I know the team as much as possible. You know, you kind of start, it becomes a trend. So.
And the second question is, also, is reasonable steps going to be defined, and what documentation is expected?
Well, that's a difficult one, as you guys probably know. You know, it depends on the circumstances. So each case is different, and the advisories say that clearly. We leave the good judgment to the registrars. What's the appropriate course of action? How you deal with that inaccuracy claim? Our job is to see whether you have taken reasonable steps, and based on the documentation you'll be providing to us, we have to make a determination. This is a very time-consuming manual process based on your documentation, what you demonstrate to us, and we have to make a determination. Yes, it is difficult. It could be arbitrary. One of the advisory did say about what will be considered as reasonable steps, right?
Okay, I think that's Tim's questions next. And Tim, please post if you had any follow-up to those. Next I have is Jeff Eckhouse.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. So I have two separate points, and I guess I'll go with the easy one first for you guys. On sort of the whole notion of, like, the bogus or the other, you know, on filtering those people out, I think one of the filtering ideas that would be helpful is on duplicate WHOIS complaints for the same domain name.
Mm-hmm.
We get those all the time. There are some people that are obsessive complainers, and they put in the complaints for the same domain name every week, and that then we have to keep responding to those. And if we could have something like, I don't know, a 30 or a 60-day lockout until the you know the time to resolve it is cleared, it would make a lot. It would be very helpful because or lock those people out. But I think that's a lot easier said than done. But if you could have a filter on a duplicates for a certain time frame, like a domain is entered in the system, nobody else can make a complaint on it for whatever time frame it is until it could be resolved, that would be very helpful. And I think it's sort of an easy fix. My second part is, if you could go back to that slide, the one with the new process, yeah. So I have a couple of issues with this one. First off, I understand that you have referenced the RAA section 342 and 343, but I think, you know, I've sort of been rereading it, and I think some of the parts that you're using for is not what it was meant for. That part of the RAA discusses you know, correspondence with the registered name holder regarding the registration and modification of their registration data. And then, you know, I don't think it pertains to parts of complaints on there. And you're saying, and we're supposed to keep the data on the registration and the updates, and that's what it was meant for. You know, if there were transfer issues, if the person requested a transfer, changes to their who is, I mean, I'm not going to read that section out loud, but to say that, I'm not sure that that applies to issues with this piece, with having to deal with complaints that are in and how we resolve them and furnish you that information. And on top of that, just for you guys to know, it says on there with reasonable notice, the notices you have sent to us, we received things. I have just some issues here where it says we received something on the 13th, and it said please furnish all of this by February 17th. I don't think 4 days is reasonable notice on top of that, but I think we should have that discussion because these are very big onerous requirements where you're asking us to, you said copies of any written communications between your registrar and the registered name holder, your registrar's findings of this complaint, and the steps your registrar took to address this complaint or otherwise. When you have a very large number of complaints coming through, to put all that documentation, to keep sending it to you in these short time frames becomes a very onerous process versus us holding on to it, and then if there's ones you want to follow up on, you can say, hey, can we look at this one? But for us to proactively send all this information to you all the time, I mean, you're going to get drowning in information as well, and I don't know if that's the best way to go forward with this. And on top of that, I'm going to, you know, we'll go through it, but I'm still not sure if the REA at that point covers that and allows for that piece.
Okay, I think that's a matter of interpretations, Jeff. You know, we can be arguing here all day, you know, whether it covers or not. We are taking that position. It does. Okay. And in terms of the first notice for who is, other areas, our usual response time is 5 days. We ask for registered to respond to us. With who is inaccuracy, we respect the contractual requirement, which is 15 days. So you will have the 15 days to respond to the first inquiry. Of notice.
Okay, I think the next person we have in the queue is Elliot.
Thanks. Hi, guys. I'm wondering, is there an alternative? I'm back on 12, I guess it is as well, the list of complaints. Is there an alternative channel for complaints, or is this all complaints?
These are all the complaints we received
so
up to February.
Is that typical that law enforcement complaints would be about 1 in 5,000 or 1/50 of 1%, or probably more fairly, because I don't know if they should be piled in with the rest, about 0.6 of a complaint a month?
Well, yeah, we're just reporting, and we only just started this process to allow law enforcement agencies to also refer matters or complaints to us. So this is very new, so it's hardly any training, you know, you can read from that.
Great. And following up on that, would those complaints, you know, and I hope the answer is yes on some level, get perhaps an expedited or, a priority treatment relative to, for instance, a false who is or a... a customer service complaint?
No. It's just follow-up process.
So is there some way that perhaps, complaints that might be more serious in nature could be, you know, I think that there's two things. You know, one, I think it's certainly relative to a lot of the dialogue that we've had in the community at this meeting and the last couple meetings, that's a surprisingly low number. Second, I do think those complaints are certainly not on par with, they're much more serious, I would imagine, than, you know, some of those other massive categories. I mean, is there a way for you to allocate your resources such that, you know, those got priority treatment? I mean, it's something that we would certainly, I'm sure, as a constituency support greatly.
Obviously, as I said, this is a new initiative or new channel of complaint that we are trialing and trying to see what works, what doesn't work. We have a designated staff looking at that, that queue in particular. But if something really jump out and that we really need to react or respond quickly, urgently, obviously, you know, then we would act quickly or promptly. So it's really case by case for me to say what will be the process. Our goal really is to be able to respond to all complaints coming through different intake system within a time frame turnaround, like a SLA turnaround time. And we're setting that goal for ourselves internally. We're measuring ourselves. We are hoping next meeting maybe we could tell you how many tickets we turn around within that time frame, that SLA. And we're going to improve that SLA time frame shorter and shorter. That's our goal, how we drive ourselves to improve our services.
So I think that's great. And I think, you know, finally, you know, I would certainly, I think we would probably all, given the current climate, certainly be interested in perhaps seeing those law enforcement complaints and the turnaround times broken out separately, you know, so that we can all ensure that they're getting the priority treatment they deserve. Thanks.
So the focus has been on the quality, not speed. Quality in the terms of process, consistency, so we can measure apple to apple, not apple to oranges. So now the process is rolled out. As Pam said, we're measuring, we're timing the processes across all areas with respect also to the contract provision and what it says it should be. And then we want to look at it, and then we start reporting on it. But I do want to remind the team, I think it was
Sorry, I didn't understand what you just said.
Okay.
I mean,
so we're focusing on the quality, meaning is the process working consistently? Are we asking for consistent data when we are processing through the steps? And then we are measuring internally how long it takes from one step to the next, and we will report back for the different areas how long to anticipate.
Maybe let me try again. I didn't understand how what you just said relates to my line of questioning.
Your line of questioning was to address if we're giving priority in one area versus the other. So my
specifically law enforcement
correct.
Versus what looks like
correct.
A DDoS attack on law enforcement.
Correct.
At this point.
So I took it to the next level because Pam answered that first question. I wanted to make sure the audience knows the process quality is what we're looking at. What does that mean? Is we are aligning all areas to be processed like a car manufacturer. It should all go through the same.
So are you saying, so you're confusing me, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Are you saying that your goal is that all complaints are treated equally?
That go through the process correctly, yes.
So then I'd like to push back on that if I can, because I do think that that makes a customer service complaint or a transfer complaint or a who is complaint effectively a DDoS attack on law enforcement complaints. There are less than one of them a month. They are obviously obvious to all of us, to you guys for sure,
mm-hmm.
of a much more serious nature than the rest. So, you know, I'd really urge you to look at, you know, perhaps instrumenting the system to create priority for those.
And we're looking at that.
Great, thank you.
But for the law enforcement process, if you recall in Dakar, we shared one of the first steps we asked law enforcement is, have you collaborated with the registrar before you submit your complaint to us? Just want to make sure that you're, I don't know if you were there in Dakar, but we had shared that process.
Yeah, but again, that would put it on a par with who is transfers
right.
and customer service, where you'd ask them the same thing.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, great. Thanks, Elliot. Next in the queue, we have a question from Luke online. Volker, you want to read that?
The question is, what have you foreseen for privacy proxy or who is privacy registration that will receive a DPRS report? Are we supposed to disclose our customers' detail by evidencing compliance that we have established contact with the registrant?
Well, you can actually redact the name. I mean, we basically want to see you. The onus is on the registrar to demonstrate their compliance. If you think you need to protect the registrant ID, you can do that. That would be acceptable.
Great. Thanks, Luke. If you need a follow-up to that, just let Volker know in the chat room. Next on the list, we have Rob.
Sorry, can we go to the screen of the world map with the percentages for where the problems are coming from? Note.
The one with Lala red pink bullets.
It's further down.
Yeah.
Keep going. Sorry. No, that one. Thank you. I find this not very helpful, especially when you say basically mirrors where all the registrars are and by volume of registration. And I think you can keep putting this up and we'll keep looking at the same thing. What might be more helpful is to say the who is in accuracy as a percentage of registrations in that region. So as opposed to worldwide. So to say 57% of the inaccuracy complaints come from North America when there might be 80% of the registrations there paints a very different picture because you might find that that's what this one is? Sorry, I missed that then. Okay, I'll sit down now. Thank you.
Aggregate, Rob, so we can do that with WHOIS in sort of break down to different complaint areas. That's really useful, very useful comment, right?
Yeah, because I think what we're ultimately trying to find out is where the problem area is, not where the volume of registrations.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Hi, Tom Barrett from NSERCA. I think all this data is great, but fairly incomplete in the sense that we're not seeing any sense of what percentage of these complaints are actually compliance issues, which is what you care about.
Yes, yes. If you could, can we go back to, is that 12, the one with three from law enforcement? Yes. That's how we break down. Customer service is not compliance issues, but the data escrow is, transfer, UDRP who is, and law enforcement, we don't really know what they are relating to, so it's just general. So these are the key areas in terms of...
So I guess what would be useful here is your analysis of how much of that 16,000 actually is a compliance issue that you feel the registrar has violated their contract.
Sure. So there's actually, when we see the compliance, sometimes it's clear-cut, kind of actual compliance. That's our determination. Sometimes it's potential compliance, and we wouldn't know whether this actual violation of the RAA until the end. Okay, so we're working on that. As you see in one of the slides, with first, second, and third. Sometimes when it's not clear-cut, we send an inquiry. When it's a clear-cut, we send a notice, okay? And we will also give you data, hopefully later on by Czech Republic. We will say how many send first notice, how many we have to send second, how many we send the third. And that should gradually decrease.
So I think what would be helpful for the next meeting is for you to come back and say, so based on you sending the first, second, and third notice, how many of these complaints you deem to be compliance issues, violations of the contract?
Yes.
That's a compliance issue, right? Not a potential one, but an actual one. So I think that would be an interesting piece of data.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks. I actually will pose a question. I think one thing that would be helpful for me is kind of as we go forward, we talked about the reasonable steps. As there's more as there's more information about what a reasonable step is, getting penetration into what that means on an ongoing basis so that registrars can understand things that are reasonable, and if that changes, it changes in the sense of what is reasonable. Or get more context for what would be reasonable under certain circumstance as that evolves. It'd be very helpful to understand what kind of bar we're kind of looking to meet when we work with you guys.
Okay. So would some of you be prepared to work with us, as kind of a working group so we can brainstorm about what really – we then can understand better what your practices are, different registrars, different practices, different operations. Like James has helped us understand what GoDaddy's practices are, right? So then maybe we can come up with some sort of a collective wisdom and have more clarity on reasonable steps.
Yeah, I'll certainly – encourage folks to think about joining in an effort like that, and I'll think about it as well. We can be in touch.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Any other comments or questions? Another one from Tim.
Europe and Asia has 3 or 4 times as many WHOIS accuracy complaints per registration as any other region. Does that look to you that there might be a deeper problem that needs to be addressed outside the WDPRS?
Sorry, Tim, can you repeat? I missed the first part of your question. I was distracted.
As Europe and Asia has 3 or 4 times as many WHOIS accuracy complaints per registration as any other region, does that look like there might be a deeper problem that needs to be addressed outside of the WDPRS?
Yes, well, that's a question. That's a great question, and we are looking into that. I don't have the answer yet, but that sort of data mining, data analysis, as Maggie said, is intended to provide us, better business intelligence so we can really think outside of the box. Maybe it's not just a WHOIS inaccuracy problem. It's a bigger problem, right?
Great, thanks. Any other comments?
John? Very quickly on the WHOIS accuracy complaints, do you have any sort of breakdown of, how many of those were ultimately related to genuinely inaccurate WHOIS data or not? I mean, for example, you know, we at iRegistry, we have a couple hundred thousand domain names. We have two registrants. They have, you know, addresses and emails and phones that we've looked at a couple of times. And we get, you know, maybe three or four of these complaints a year because someone says, oh, well, I sent them an email, you know, about some obnoxious topic and I didn't get an answer. And so then they make a Whois Data problem report. So, you know, we're constantly having to confirm the accuracy of, you know, the same two registrants whose details are accurate. And I'm wondering what that experience is like with other registrars, that people make a Whois Data problem report because they didn't get an answer to something that they're not entitled to an answer to, or they didn't get an answer they like, or, you know, some other, for whatever reason, the domain name registrant just does not wish to engage in communications with that person. So then they go to the problem report system, you know, it comes through. So I'm just curious what the experience is with that across the board, that you know, I mean, you can get, you know, 10,000 complaints, but I'd love to know how many times the Whois Data was actually inaccurate.
Yeah, I think Matt, you have a comment on the question that he posed.
Yeah, no, John, that's a good point. And my personal observation is that there's more and more of that. You know, we get it all the time. You know, we're the registrar of record for some large brand holders, and we get, you know, I tried to contact Facebook and they didn't respond to me. And so what I'd like to understand is what, and Maggie, we've talked a little bit about this, is what kind of review process and how are you guys constantly tweaking that to make sure that stuff doesn't flow through ultimately to the registrar? Because like John said, you know, I mean, I don't think Google's updated their Whois record in, you know, 10 years. So the information's accurate. They're just choosing not to respond to you, and that's their right. So I don't know how we can work with you to kind of look at that more, but I'm seeing a lot more of that over the last, you know, 12, 18 months.
Sorry, I'm curious about that comment. You say they chose not to respond to it. That's their right. But they also have an obligation under your registration agreement with them. They have to update their Whois.
But Pam, that data has not.
Let me make it real clear, okay? When someone sends a death threat, okay, to one of my registrants saying, you've got that domain name and I want it and you won't sell it to me and you won't answer it to me and I know where you live and I'm going to come down to Cayman and find you. It's a small island. Okay, that's the kind of communication I've gotten. They don't get an answer. But then they go and make a Whois Data problem report because they didn't make an answer, and they involve you in the loop of cyber stalking and harassment of the registrants.
Sure, but we don't have that visibility. What's the lurking in the background? What's the motive, right? We look at the complaint at face value.
But you have some idea of, I mean, ultimately, you want to know if a Whois Data, if you had 10,000 Whois Data problem reports, don't you want to know how many Whois Data problems there were? Or how often that system is being used as part of stalking, abuse, harassment. People don't have to respond to communications. And the Whois Data problem reports that I see and that a lot of the other registrars see is, I called them up on the telephone and they didn't want to talk to me. Or they didn't want to answer the telephone. Or they didn't want to answer my email about it. I mean, it is not an invitation to become the pen pal and phone chat friend to the world just because you've registered a domain name. So if people don't get answers, they say, oh, well, the data must be incorrect, and they make a complaint. So I really want to get, you know, just some idea of what the proportion of that is how often that system is being used as a tool to abuse domain registrants.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. At least we now have that background. And we will, again, we the system enhancement initiative we have, we'll take that into account, see whether we can have a more intelligent system.
Yeah, thanks. And I think with that, our time is concluded. So thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
May I have my USB, please?
Yes. And next on our agenda is an update from the NomCom. I don't know, we have slides for the NomCom update. Rob, do you just chat away? You guys have 15 minutes, so. Walk it around. I'm not sure if I can grab it. guess we'll hope we don't get any very interesting Skype conversations coming in. Maybe we'll try and turn off Skype.
So, good morning. Thank you for having us this morning here. And, well, as you all know, ATRT are demand us to have some feedback from the community. We have done last year some inquiries about what is going on, what is the profile we need to have from the new members that we will select for the board. So this time, what I want to just show to you and ask for your feedback is what we got from last year, interviews about the whole community, and if it's enough, it's correct our understanding, or if you want to add something or withdraw something from this profile that we in some way resume from all the interviews. So please, next slide. It's just to remember that we have a 3-year term, three board members, and one of those members must be now from Latin America and Caribbean region, because the bylaws demand that you cannot have 0 person from one region, and the only candidate, the only board member that we already have from the Latin America Caribbean area is leaving in the end of this year. So we need to do that. 2 members from the at-large, this time from Europe and North America, 1 member from the GNSO for 2-year term, and another member for the CCNSO, 3 years member term. Next slide, please. So that is our timeline. We're going to post this in the end of this week for the whole community. That's why I'm asking for the feedback. So that is our timeline. So we have a tight schedule. And in Praha, we should finish our selection. So we're going to close on the April 2nd. I believe, yeah, April 2nd. So we have all the contracted party to interview all the pre-selected candidates. And after that, we're going to have a face-to-face meeting and interview for all a small part of this pre-selected group for the board members. And in the end of the meeting in Praha, we're going to retreat and go to the end to get consensus in the which will be the final candidates and the final member that we will select for all positions. So that is our time. So in August, we should have done with this. This is our schedule. So please, next slide. So what we got from the community during our many interviews last year with all of you, it's what we got from experience, technical, that need to have at least a general idea about the major technical issues facing the internet. Police must be well aware about many policy issues, but needs to remember that it's not their job to do policy, but needs to understand that. Governance, it's not only managed skills, but board experience. Board experience in similar and higher size organization is quite relevant. Ability to easily communicate in English, but other language nowadays, it's more and more important to be able to speak more than one language. The next one. So the general skill set is ability to list, good to build in relationship, diplomatic attitude. We cannot face the community or the governance without some kind of diplomatic skills. And executive mind, decision maker, can get all the information and make decision with this amount of information in a short period of time. Integrity, honesty, of course, confident but not arrogant. We don't want people stand there, you know, in some way to facing in an arrogant way the community. So another one, please. Accept public criticism with elegance, ability to delegate, because that is not board executive task to do. It's just supervise and have a board functionality. A strong understand and believe in ICANN multi-stakeholder. You cannot defend something if you don't believe. Understand that clear communication with the community is an important part of the consensus building process, and time availability is relevant. Next one, I guess, is... So, I need suggestion. It's... we could get those information, and it's not only for you, certainly, it's all the information we got from all the ACs and SOs, and even from the board, too. There is, we try to make this resume. So that's the idea. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Great. Anyone in the queue? Michele, you have a comment on this, or any questions? Rob?
Rob, please.
Thank you, Vanda. I have a bit of a different job here, so many of you may know. I am the chair-elect, so I will chair the next session of the NOMCOM, which begins in Toronto. So this is the first time this position has existed, and it gives me the advantage of being able to come out to groups like the registrars and say, I need your candidate earlier than normal. So you'll see me start to, between now and Prague, ask you for to start thinking about who is your candidate that you will seat in October. Last year, it got left to, you know, typically because of the old process, it would get left to the last minute. This year, you're going to be seeing it gray. You'll be getting a letter officially from me asking the constituency to pick who their representative will be. Currently, it's Krista Papik. She is eligible for another year, but certainly I'll be coming out and saying, please run your election process and get me a candidate, hopefully by Prague or shortly thereafter.
Thank you. Great. Thanks. James.
Just a quick question for Rob or a guest or whoever wants to answer is, what was the takeaway from the speech yesterday? And I think the outgoing president had some pretty sharp words for NOMCOM and conflicts. I mean, do you guys see that, or is that just?
I wasn't actually at the presentation. I don't think it's the nominating committee's position to comment on that. We are a structure of the board. The board appoints Vanda and I. We serve at their pleasure. The structure is in the bylaws as to who is on the nominating committee. For example, the registrars are able to elect someone to the nominating committee. I think it's up to the board to comment if they wish to, not the nominating committee to comment, as it's, our structure is not within our control.
Yeah. Let me just compliment that. It was just so tall. So I can compliment that. It was there, even its CEO, its Rod expressed his idea about that. We have tested this idea last year, and the idea to have a foreign headhunters to get, you know, outreach and make this selection didn't work. We really tested that last year. We hired a company, an international company, and we got just 8 applications, and those 8 applications, one was invited by me, the other 7 was invited by the former chair. So, and from those 8, just 1 applied. So it was really difficult for someone from outside the community to really convince people to understand first what is the community is about and take that position. So we have tested that. I respect the idea, but it's not the idea of the board, and I ask to direct the board. So there is nothing that is really related to this thing. We respond directly to the board. The group is completely independent. We have the first thing that is sign up a conflict of interest. So I never saw in these 12 years I'm in the ICANN any questions related to conflict of interest coming from the non-com. So I believe that is that. Thank you.
Okay, great. Stefan?
Yeah, thanks, Gray. I think Vanda's been very diplomatic, and I don't think, if I'm slightly less diplomatic, I think Rod's speech was appalling, to be honest. The NOMCOM is an independent body. It's a crucial part of the ICANN structure. Those criticisms had no place there in that public forum. They felt to me like a parting shot and a low one at that. Obviously, the board and private members in private conversations with the board and NOMCOM since that, there's a lot of discomfort with those words. And I think it's something that our community should also look at, because some of the stuff that was said and one inference that was made by Rod, which was that the board was riddled with industry insiders, where in actual fact there are only two industry people on the board. And I would actually say that they industry people on the board help anchor the ICANN board to its community and are a good thing. I think those comments really are troublesome to us, and we may actually want to, certainly in private conversations which we all have with board members, pursue that conversation. I know it was a shock to the board. I think it was a shock. I've spoken to some of the NOMCOM members, and it was a shock to them. And I think it should be a shock to us.
Perhaps I can just speak to the internal conflict of interest policies that may not be aware. I know that the NOMCOM often hasn't been as transparent as I believe it should be. First, you cannot sit on the NOMCOM if you're a staff member, so that's been ruled out. So there's no conflict with anyone taking money. Anyone that's employed or contracted to ICANN cannot be a member of the NOMCOM. The big conflict of the NOMCOM potentially comes from when one of the NOMCOM members knows a candidate. And so we have an internal conflicts committee that NOMCOM member would go to and say, I know this candidate. I have a conflict with this candidate. They work for me. I know them too well. I'd like to be excused from the debate on this candidate. And so there's an internal conflicts committee. It was one of the first things we set up that will look at, is that person in conflict with that candidate? Because the last thing we want to do is disadvantage a candidate. So our conflict procedures are very much in place and very much are there to protect the candidate and ensure that there's no discrimination whatsoever because someone knows them or has a business relationship or a conflict with them individually.
Thanks. With that, I think we've reached our time for this segment of the day. Next, but I believe we have Kurt Pritz for 45 minutes. Although I don't see Kurt in the room. So I guess thank you to the NOMCOM folks for joining us. And I guess one question would be whether or not, I don't think we received this deck, if you could send us this deck so we can just send it out to the list. Yeah, why don't we take a five-minute break while we wait for Kurt to get here? Oh, he is joining us momentarily. Hey, Kurt. You know, in an effort to intimidate people that come before us, we're sitting on stage. And I guess, Kurt, I think this was billed as a Q&A session from our perspective. So I guess I'll start taking a cue. Kurt, go ahead. And you know, why don't you just grab the microphone and you guys can just hold that and pass it around.
Well, thank you for having us, even in this kind of barrier to communication. First, Kimberly is going to give a couple updates that on work we've been doing administratively that she had planned. Are you ready to do that? Okay.
Hello. Since Tim Cole and Mike Zupke couldn't be here, I'm going to just go over a few of the updates for the team. Okay, so the first one is just going to be about the Registrar Training Program, and I'm going to provide you with a little bit of background first for those who may need it. So the Registrar Training Program was a new requirement for the 2009 RAA, and it's actually required for all registrars to complete. The training program is, can't read this. It's offered by ICANN at no cost to the registrars. It's online, and it's actually in seven different languages. The training program must be completed by the primary contact or a designee who is an employee of the registrar or an affiliated registrar. There are six courses within the training program. The first one is an introduction and ICANN background. The second one is dealing with the registrants. The third course is transfer policy, and the fourth one is dealing with the UDRP. The fifth course is the who is and data management obligations, and the sixth course is RAA enforcement and administration, such as how do I change my primary contact information. So the content is mostly in video form, but there's also some takeaway quick reference materials that you can have. The total running time is approximately 2 hours, and registrars are given about 90 days to complete the training after they are enrolled. If you need an extension, then you can request one. Right now, the current status, there are about 759 registrars in 16 countries that have been enrolled in the training program as of today, which is about more than 80% of the registrars on the 2009 RAA. There are 526 registrars that have completed the training program. Approximately 70% of the enrolled registrars have completed this training. Nine registrars or registrar families have requested and been provided additional access to the training program for employers other than the primary contact. And this is part of a trial voluntary training program. Across these registrars, there are 53 voluntary registrars that are taking this program. A registrar can sign up to 10 voluntary learners as part of the trial. Otherwise, they can wait until we send out an email invitation to all the registrars for this voluntary program when it's out of beta testing. And if there are any registrars interested in joining the trial, then you can send an email to registrar-training@icann.org. There are translated versions of the training program, and they're expected to launch in the next week, a week and a half, and registrars on the 2009 RAA in countries where the primary language is Chinese, French, Japanese, Korean, Russian, or Spanish will receive an emailed enrollment details within the next week or two. All registrars on the 2009 RAA will be enrolled by the end of the month. And new registrars will be enrolled as part of their onboarding process. And if you have any other questions regarding the training program, Mike should be online or he's called in and he can answer any other, if you have any questions regarding that. No. Do you have any questions regarding the training program or any information that Mike can kind of go over?
I think that's no hands means no, I guess. Unless there's someone typing online, we'll get back if that was.
Okay. I'm also going to just mention very briefly the RDE enrollment and onboarding procedure. A lot of the registrars have received invocations saying that we now require that all registrars sign an RDE agreement. Even if you have no names, we still need you to sign it. And as of February of this year, this is a new requirement. And we also ask that you start depositing data as soon as you start registering names. Now, there will be some overlap that once you start depositing, your information may still say that you are out of compliance or you haven't begun depositing. So there may be about a 30-day overlap. Once the application is approved for new registrars, the RDE enrollment letter is sent out along with the 2009 RAA, and this will function as a formal notice to registrars of their obligation. And this process is actually different. Before you did the RAA, you turned in your accreditation fees, and then later we asked you to submit the RDE agreement. For new applications, the accreditation will not be completed until we receive your 2009 RAA, your RDE agreement, and your accreditation fees, and any other information that we require. This process actually makes it easier and more efficient for the registrar liaison team and contractual compliance to provide any technical information assistance that we can, along with Iron Mountain, and also so we don't have to go back and chase registrars after the fact. Are there any questions regarding the new onboarding?
I don't see any.
Okay. And the last thing, due diligence checks. In the interest of protecting registrants and ensuring the security and stability of the domain name space, we have recently implemented an enhanced registrar applicant background check. And I believe this was started December of last year. There's a third-party provider that we use in conjunction with our own internal process to conduct these background checks. And there's also more detailed terms and conditions that go along with governing the process. So when an applicant is, when we have any questions or concerns for the applicant, they are given a chance to explain or clarify their answers, which goes along with the same process that we use now. And that is all I have.
Thanks. You have a comment?
Sorry, just to get an understanding. So you're running a background check on any new applicants?
Yes.
What about the existing registrars?
I'm sorry?
What about the existing registrars?
No, these are only for new applicants. All registrars that are applying, even if you are already accredited and you are sending in more applications, those will apply for that. But it won't necessarily be for every application that comes in. It all depends on you know, case by case. Brian also has a presentation for the IRTP Part B. Do you have
a slide deck or?
Yeah, I think
there should be one loaded already, but I also have it on a USB.
I guess the question would be, is there one loaded met?
Yes.
We'll be pulling it up shortly. Yes?
This is Tim Paul.
Hey, Tim.
I want to let you know that both Mike Dusty and I are on the call if anyone has any questions for us.
Tim, I'd just say it's a little bit difficult to hear you, so maybe get closer to the microphone.
Okay, sorry. I just wanted to let you know that both Mike Dusty and I are on the call if anyone has questions for us.
Yeah, can we, technical... Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Just run.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to... Sorry. Good morning, everybody. Wanted to give you a brief update on the status of implementing the IRTP B revisions to the policy. As you're probably aware, since hopefully everyone received their notification on February 29th, there are two primary aspects to the changes to the IRTP. The first one is the new obligation for registrars to provide a transfer emergency action contact, or TEAC. Under this obligation, messages that are received or sent via the TEAC require a human or non-automated response within 4 hours. Obviously, the ultimate resolution might take longer than that, but there should be at least an initial response to that request through the TEAC within 4 hours, again, with a human response. And that response should be from someone or the group that is capable of understanding the issue and able to follow through and authorized to investigate and address the issue that is raised in the TEAC communication. Okay. Next slide. The other aspect are revisions to the current IRTP policy. The first is a modification making it now a requirement or an obligation that the losing registrar must notify the registrar name holder or the registrant of transfer out request. The other are modifications to two of the denial reasons. The first one is now that for denial reason number 6 now requires that the objection must be provided with the express and informed consent of the authorized transfer contact on an opt-in basis. The third change is a removal of the previous denial reason number 7, which required or was a reason for denying a request when the domain name was already in lock status. Given that it was technically impossible to do so, there was no reason to have a denial reason, and so that denial reason has been deleted from the policy. Next slide. In terms of implementation, as mentioned, all registrars should have received an official notice of implementation on February 29th. The reasonable period of time to come into compliance with these obligations in terms of establishing the TEAC operation as well as complying with the new revisions to the policy itself will be the 1st of June 2012. We recently have posted the revisions or the revised IRTP on the website at that links. We will be providing further explanations and updating the web page and providing a reminder to the registrars in the coming weeks or in a month or so that will also provide additional information in terms of TEAC implementation and the revisions to draw attention to the revisions or revised text on the website. Next slide. In terms of implementing the TEAC, some instructions sent out with a notification that went out on the 29th of February. A new contact field has been set up in RADAR for each registrar to enter into the contact details for its transfer emergency action contact. When it went live a couple weeks ago, ICANN has initially populated that field with information on either on file for the registrar's transfer contact or primary contact if the transfer contact was not present. Registrars, since it is live, are encouraged to fill that field or update it with if they have a specific TIAC contact, or if they're if they're happy with that being the transfer contact, that's the default at this time. Once logged into RADAR, registrars have access to the contact information for all the other registrars by going to View All Registrars button on the left side of the screen. As I said, this feature is live now, but the actual communication aspects and the use of TIAC will not go live until the 1st of June. Okay. And just some further explanation on how the process will work. As mentioned, the entire process of the communication function will go live on the 1st of June. The losing registrar will then be able to use the communication tool to send the emergency action contact to the gaining registrar's TIAC at that time. That message will have a time and date stamped to facilitate compliance with the four-hour response requirement, and a record of that communication will be, along with that date and time stamp, will be maintained by ICANN staff for future access if necessary if there's a dispute or any aspect concerning that particular communication. Okay. That's it. Any questions on the TIAC and or the IRTP revisions?
Yeah, I think there was one online from Rob Golden. Question, why have the recommendations of the IRTP-B working group been changed? It wasn't that a quote-unquote human responded within 4 hours, as managers sleep even techies don't.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
It wasn't, state the question again. Question, why have the recommendations of the IRTP-B working group been changed? It wasn't that a human, quote-unquote, responded within 4 hours. Open paren, as managers sleep even if techies don't. Close paren,
Okay. I don't think so.
So just take that question and we'll get back.
Yeah, we'll take the question and get back because I don't believe it has been changed, but we'll go into that and see.
Okay, great. Okay. Any other questions on this?
No.
Okay. Seeing none?
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I just want to ask Kimberly and maybe Tim on the phone, could you take the comments you made verbally here and put them in some sort of very brief update to the registrars that we can send to them so that there's full understanding? Thanks.
Sure.
Are there more slides on this?
No, no, we're done.
What?
Well, we're done with that
okay,
part
great.
Of the update, so we can go on to questions you might have.
Any questions up here for Kurt? Guess there. I believe you said it was open for questions. Did not specify whether they were awkward or unawkward.
Hi, Tom Barrett from Inserca. So my understanding is that under this new requirement that losing registrars must now send an email to registrants for all transfers, right? As a notice or acknowledgement? And I wonder if this is going to lead, if there was any discussion about how some registrars might use this new requirement to slow down transfer requests.
I was going to, do you want to respond?
What?
I said I was going to respond to that, actually.
That would be terrific.
So, yeah, no, Michaela and I were figuring out who was going to. So Tom, just to be clear, what Brian was talking about was the implementation that came out of the IRTP-B working group, which McKaylee chaired, myself, James, and several other registrars participated in. So
And we concluded that work a year ago-ish, 9 months, something, a couple meetings ago. So now they're just onto the implementation phase, and so we considered a whole host of factors, but that was one of the recommendations that came out of the work that we had done out of IRTPB.
And just to speak to your specific concerns, the existing IRTP policy, in other words, the transfer policy, gives you as a registrar the option to send that email. The only change is it's now become obligatory. And if you actually look at to see what most of the larger registrars are doing, is most of them are actually sending that email anyway. So to be perfectly honest, from the work we did, the input we've got back from others, we considered it to be a minor change because a lot of the larger registrars were already doing it.
And specifically, specifically, the transfer cannot be interrupted, delayed, or held up based on the registrar, the losing registrar, sending that FOA. So that's not a dependency in the whole process. That is for the gaining, and it always has been. But that is not I think to your specific concern that a registrar might abuse that, it's not possible.
Any other questions or comments on that point? Seeing none, I think we're back to comments from Kurt or questions from us.
May I make a comment?
Please do. Please, who is this on the line, just so everyone knows?
In answering the questions on the training program, I answered it wrong because I stated that it was required to be a certain letter. And now saying it's not totally required, but it is now, there may be a necessity to take a look into the training program to see if it remains consistent with the rules. This would be from Mike.
I'm not sure that most of that message came through. It was a little bit difficult to hear. I'm sorry. Maybe you could repeat the point again. Or type or even better, why don't you type the question into the chat room.
The training program must be examined to see if it's consistent with the rules that the NRB amended.
Okay.
This is Dan Halloran. I think the question was.
We've got a procedure in place internally to periodically review the training content.
Oh, Mike's in.
It still is applicable and current. You know, we recognize there's a delay. In fact, the disclaimers you need to click through in order to get the content is acknowledging that you understand that there may be.
Excuse me, on the telephone, I think.
The content was created and the time of quality has changed and the new the content has been updated. It is something that we work on and we intend to keep updated.
This is Dan Halloran. So I think, to the people on the phone, we couldn't hear you well. What I pieced together was, I think it was Bob Connolly maybe asked, is the training program going to be updated to reflect these changes to the transfer program? And I think Mike answered, yes, we're going to periodically review the training program to make sure changes to the training program get incorporated.
Thank you so much for that. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, I think this session was scheduled to go for about 20 more minutes. So we have some. Kurt, final parting shot.
Well, if there's no questions here, certainly we're here the rest of the week just the same as you. And if there's any meetings that need to occur or discussions. Just write any of us that you've seen here, and we'll pull together to talk about issues that arise as the meeting goes on, as they're sure to.
Great, thanks so much. And with that, I believe the next item on our agenda here is a closed session number 2 at 11:15. So why don't we'll take a 15-minute break. and see everyone back here at 11:15 for a closed session.